From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning we speak with renowned creativity and performance coach Sam Bennett, the author of the new book, The 15-Minute Method, and then Cy Hutt, the president of Intermountain Heber Valley Hospital, where they're celebrating 25 years of healthcare. That's all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
If you're an overworked professional, a creative type with too many unfinished projects, not that I know anything about that, or a parent who rarely has a free moment, and you've tried and struggled with productivity solutions in the past, a new book from Sam Bennett, The 15-Minute Method, may be the different kind of approach you've been hoping for. With equal roles as cheerleader, therapist, coach, and poet, Sam Bennett both takes apart the excuses we tell ourselves and builds us up with concrete strategies for moving forward with the projects that mean the most to us. Author, coach, speaker, workshop facilitator extraordinaire, Sam Bennett, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Well, let's start with this. You're often described as a creativity slash productivity coach. A great combo, since many of the creative folks I know, some that I know very well, have trouble managing projects, staying organized, or finishing things. What is it about these wonderful creative people that you think contributes to these kind of tendencies?
Creativity has to do with innovative problem solving. If you've ever solved a problem differently than anybody else has ever solved the problem, congratulations, you are a creative genius. So starting there. And then there's some people who have, and everybody's got at least one zone of creative genius, right? Something that they're just naturally good at, naturally have always been interested in, always had sort of a knack for, and maybe you're the only one in your family or your friend group with this, you know, interest. You know, you get that sort of like, wait, you're paying how much to go to a conference where, on what? Like, and you're like, no, no, it's fun for me, right? Whatever that is, that's probably your zone of creative genius. Then there's people with multiple zones of creative genius, right? People who are good at a lot of things. And I call those people highly creative people. And one of the things with highly creative people is they have a grillion ideas all the time. They have ideas in the middle of the day. They have ideas in the middle of the night. They have ideas about your ideas. They have ideas about their own ideas while they're having other ideas. They get distracted by the new idea because that one seems better because it's new. And this other one that I'm halfway through now seems boring and I don't want to do it anymore. And I just want to point out, this is not a character defect, right? Sometimes this gets talked about like, oh, they're dilettantes, or oh, they can't settle, or sparkly things, squirrel, whatever. I'm like, no. Just have a lot of ideas all the time. It's delightful. It's a lovely quality in a person. You do, however, need to manage the flow of ideas. Like, you want to have some way to capture and retrieve the ideas. People sometimes say like, oh, I keep a journal, which is amazing. But journal keeping is about process. It's not about retrieval, right? You put an idea into a journal, God help you, you're never going to find it again, right? It's never going to come back to you. So have some way to both capture those ideas and retrieve them, whether it's online or I like index cards, whatever, you know, whatever works for you. Voice memos, sometimes people leave themselves voice memos. It's all good. So I think that's one problem, is we just have a ton of ideas and it's hard to know which one's the one to pursue, or which one's really going to be worth it. The other problem is this thing I alluded to before, which is it being good at a lot of things. Got a lot of talents and skills. It's not always obvious to us where the money is, where the satisfaction is going to be, you know. And we end up with these sort of patchwork resumes of, you know, well, I was a whitewater river guide, and well, I worked in development for HGTV, and well, I was an executive assistant to I produced radio dramas. I actually literally had all those jobs. but again, there's no law that says real success is a straight line, right? Or you should only do one thing your whole life. And if anybody's having that sensation of like, oh, I'm starting over, like, oh, I'm starting from scratch, I'm starting over. No, you're not. You bring the fullness of your experience and your life and everything you've learned to everything you do. And every minute you're getting better and better and swifter and swifter and, you know, more elegant in your solutions. And it's beautiful to be a beginner.
It is. I call that mosaic thinking or mosaic living.
Yes.
Like all these little pieces of us, it's like that Steve Jobs commencement speech. You don't always know how the calligraphy class that you were drawn to take or,
right.
you know, this book club book that you read or whatever, how those all might contribute to the whole. You just have to trust sometimes.
My favorite thing probably about being a writer is actually in writing, you can just pull from everything, you know, the thing the camp counselor said when you were nine and the thing your Aunt Nana used to say and that one thing you noticed in a store that one time, like everything gets to be useful. It's really appeals to my sense of like reduce, reuse, recycle.
It does. And I, as I get older, I'm noticing how maybe there's been a consolidation of a lot of my memories. I don't just remember things as specifically as I feel like I used to. So it tells me something interesting if I'm remembering a remark that somebody made 15 years ago or some line in a song still is with me. I'm like, it's here for some reason. So pay attention to that. Maybe it's going to fill a little spot in that puzzle somewhere. I love the concept in your book about it. There being no bad ideas. Could you tell us a little bit about approaching our ideas and evaluating them?
Yeah, I hear it from all the time of like, oh, I have an idea, but I'm not sure if it's a good idea. And I always want to say, sweetheart, there's no such thing as a good idea. There's just ideas. And one of the ways I learned this deeply in my bones was working in improvisational comedy for so long, because you know, when you go out there to start a scene with nothing, it's just you and the other person, or sometimes just you, and there's no script and there's no set and there's no costumes and there's no director. And it's just you just making it up as you go. The only idea is the idea that's right in front of you. If you're waiting to have a good idea to start a scene, you and the audience are going to be standing there for a really long time. And anything can be turned, even the worst ideas can be turned into a good idea, right?
Right.
So the important thing I think is to just, like I said, capture them and then start, take a couple little baby steps, you know, do a little research, do a little investigation, ask somebody smarter than you, you know, like, or just trust your own inner knowing and be patient with the not knowing. That like, I don't know why I want to write all these things down. I don't know why I'm having this vision of a stained glass window in my bathroom. I don't know why I'm thinking, well, I don't know either. But if it's knocking on your door, answer the door.
Or as Oprah would say, you know, first it comes as a trickle and then it comes as a rainstorm and then it's hailing on your roof. So if you're getting this message over and over, there's likely some purpose that it's meant to serve in your life.
That's right. And I think partly it's an inside outside problem too, right? We look at other people's work and it all seems so good and so inevitable and so like, oh, they did the perfect thing. Oh, why can't I find the perfect thing? And I got to tell you, I'm sure you have this experience too. I mean, I've worked with Academy Award winners, Emmy Award winners, award-winning writers, people at the very top of their game, CEOs. And nobody ever feels like they have a good idea or the right idea. Everybody has this insecurity. Everybody thinks, oh gosh, I don't know. What about this? What about that? Like, that's just part of the creative process.
Exactly.
So quit thinking that, you know, quit comparing, as they say in 12 step, quit comparing your insides to everybody else's outsides, you know, or as I heard one person say one time, we look at other people and we see their beautiful gardens. We look at ourselves and we just see these little seeds.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, I have a friend who went to school with the songwriter Diane Warren, who's, you know, one of the most prolific and acknowledged,
commercially successful of all time.
Right. Tons of Academy Awards and stuff. And he said, they're still in touch. And he said that she would call him at like 3 a.m. with an idea and be like, should I write it? Like even now. And I'm thinking, I love that story because if Diane Warren is still figuring out whether she wants to put in the time to like develop this idea into a song and looking for a little bit of validation, then why shouldn't we? Why shouldn't each of us feel okay about that?
Exactly. So learn to be patient with yourself. And also it can be a great point of self-inquiry to say like, wow, where do I stop myself? where do I put up the brick wall? Where do I say, you know, no, I'm not even going to consider that, or no, I'm not even willing to test that, or no, I'm not even, I'm willing to test it, but I'm not willing to share it with other people, or I'm willing to share it with other people, but not a whole audience of other people. I'm willing to share it with a whole.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. How do you suggest that people kind of realize, because we all have, you know, I call them the flower projects or the oak tree projects, you know, the little ones that are meant to come and go, and then the ones that are kind of a long haul. So how do you approach that?
Well, it's a little different for me because I make my living off of my creativity, right? So my ideas turn into workshops, turn into retreats, turn into talks, turn into books. So there is a certain financial evaluation that I have to do of like, is this, do I think I can sell this? You know, there are definitely other projects that I do just for me that I don't either want to sell or need to sell, or I don't know if they are saleable, but I'm just interested anyway. Like I'm willing to sort of go on the journey. You know, I think of somebody asked me one time, like, how do you tell the difference between the natural reluctance a person feels when they're starting something new versus that deep gut, like, this isn't the right thing for me feeling? And I said, you know, I'm not sure you can tell before you start. Those feelings are so similar that I think you just have to start taking baby steps and see what happens. And this is partly where I started talking about the whole 15 minute a day thing. I'm like, just start with 15 minutes a day. See how it feels, see how it goes. And we've all had the experience of starting little tiny, you know, making one phone call, starting to jot out some ideas, make an outline, whatever it is, however you like to work. And all of a sudden the universe comes rushing at you. You know, like all of a sudden the opportunity is right in front of you. And I hear the story all the time where people are like, well, Sam, I didn't think your 15 minute a day thing was going to work for me, but I said, you know, but I paid you a ton of money, so I had to do it. So one thing about charging more is that people tend to do what you tell them to do because they paid you too much to not listen. So if you're reluctant to raise your prices, hear me now. So, you know, oh, I didn't think it would work, but I was trying it because you said to do it. And sure enough, the next thing I knew, I was in line at the dry cleaner and I saw my neighbor, and it turns out her sister is a literary agent. And now I've got a meeting on Thursday. I'm like, right.
I love it. Well, I remember stories from when I was a kid about the power of compound interest, like a little boy who would like deposit a quarter in his investment bank account every day. And by the time he was 18, he had like $100,000 or something. And your new book, The 15-Minute Method, highlights that similar power of committing to small increments of time and effort in order to reap big progress on our most meaningful areas of life. How did the idea of the 15-Minute Method come about for you?
Yeah, well, I certainly didn't invent it. I mean, lots of people have talked about this. And then there's other, you know, Pomodoro techniques talks about 20 minutes. You know, there's all kinds of different time limits like that. I love 15 minutes partly because it just feels very digestible to me. Like no matter how busy you are, you can find 15 minutes. You know, you read those articles, they're like, you should be exercising 5 hours a week. I'm like, really? What 5 hours is that? Could you share those with me? Because I'm not seeing them. I used to see them, but now I don't. I haven't seen them for a while. But 15 minutes, everybody's got 15 minutes. And it is astonishing how much a person can get done in 15 minutes. And it is even more astonishing the results of 15 minutes every day, as you say, for a month, for 6 months, for 6 years, for 66 years, like you can achieve amazing things. And like in some ways it sort of makes logical sense. Like, okay, I get it. If I practice my ukulele every day for 15 minutes and not very much time, I would probably be a better ukulele player. And that's good. Right. The world needs more good ukulele players.
Maybe.
Don't know. But there's other projects where you feel like, oh God, but you know, I want to write a book, or I need to clean out the garage, or like, I can't do that in 15 minutes. Like, well, but can you? I mean, if you write for 15 minutes a day, you can get out 200 to 250 words. And in 200 days, that's 50,000 words. That's a book.
That's a book.
So where were you 200 days ago? And would you like to have a book today? Or at least a draft? Right. And the garage thing, this is the story I keep telling. Like, this is what's in my mind about the garage. It's like, okay, you know, oh, Sam, I need 2 free weekends to clean out the garage. Again, show me which 2 free weekends those are. And if you did have 2 free weekends, would you really want to spend them in the garage?
Exactly.
So like you're setting yourself up to fail right there. But so let's say instead, like, okay, I'm gonna try Sam's 15 minute thing. And so maybe take a cup of something, you know, warming. I've got my tea and my Art Before Housework mug here. And I'm just gonna go out to the garage and I'm just gonna contemplate the garage. I'm not gonna do anything. I'm just gonna be there with it. I'm gonna sit there. I'm gonna see what the garage has to say to me. I'm just gonna take it in. And it may be that at minute 11, you go, wait a minute. Those 8 boxes belong to my brother, Jeffrey. Those aren't even mine. We call Jeffrey, come get your boxes. Right? Okay, well, now we've cleaned out a whole corner and we don't have to do anything. And maybe the next day we go in and we look in one of those big Rubbermaid tubs that we all have. And we say, oh, this is holiday stuff. Great, so I'm gonna label it holiday and I wanna put it in the back because I only need that stuff once a year. And maybe the next day I take that broken bicycle and I roll it out to the curb and I put a sign on it that says free broken bicycle, right? So in this fashion, in fact, we can clean out the garage in 15 minutes a day.
I love that. It's almost kind of taking a gestalt version of looking at this space or this book or whatever it is as an entity and listening to it. I love that. Just the idea that it wants to exist in some way and it'll give you clues if you let it.
And really, and it gives you a second to start to understand some of the underlying psychological things that may be going on. I had a bunch of stuff that I refused to look at it. I refused to unpack it. I refused to get rid of it. I refused, like, it was just surprised at how resistant I was to doing anything about it. When I gave myself a little space to just, like I said, sort of be with it and think about what was really happening, I realized it was my family's stuff. And as the eldest daughter of the eldest daughter, I had sort of appointed myself keeper of all the things. And when I realized, like, oh, yeah, that's not actually my job. No one asked me to do that. These stuff in these boxes are not my grandmother's. You know, my relationship with her is intact. And I could hear her in my mind going, Samantha, please. Like, you know, there's this beautiful set of fine china. She's like, what, you're going to start having sit-down dinners for 16? I don't think so. Like, she was a very practical person. She was not a very sentimental person. And like allowing myself to, you know, just get out of the self-punishment cycle of like, oh my God, I can't believe I haven't done this already. And to go a little deeper and give myself the time and space to go a little deeper allowed me to go, okay, you know what? I really can get rid of a lot of this stuff. And some of it I really do want to keep and like display and enjoy in my life because it does remind me of those ties.
Yeah, well, there's a great section in your book where you give these examples of excuses that people give about why they can't start something. I'm too busy, or it's not the right time, or this person needs me right now. Give us a couple examples of responses to these that we can give to ourselves.
Yeah. This is the tough love, like get like real talk part of the book. This is the real talk part. Well, we were talking earlier about like, oh, I don't know if this is a good idea or not. When people say that to me, it often indicates either I don't trust my own intuition or inner knowing, and or I am unwilling to ask an expert. Because if you're in a spin about whether or not something's a good idea, those two sources of information will be helpful to you.
Yeah.
And if you're cutting yourself off from them, then what are you really doing? Then you're just enjoying being in a spin, right?
Right.
This whole, oh, my family needs me. Oh, my work needs me. Oh, my kids need me. Now, of course, there are times in life that are, you know, high pressure or emergencies. And yes, those people do need you. But that's not day to day, right? For most of us. So is the real thought underneath this something more like it feels safer for me to put everybody else's needs first, right? Is it I feel more approved of if I put everybody else's needs first?
It's more socially acceptable.
We certainly get that message societally from every corner, right? That what we do for other people matters way more than what we do for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And in fact, even the doing something for yourself is what? Selfish.
The Cinderella creativity complex sometimes. It's like, I can only do these things after everything else is done and the house is clean and everyone's cared for. It's a losing right. battle.
It's a guaranteed way to not do your stuff, right? And, you know, I have a couple of thoughts about that. One is, I don't think any of us want to be, you know, haunting our own memorial service and overhearing everybody going, well, her tile grout was just impeccable. You know, like, boy, he never put a foot wrong. You know, he just never let anybody down ever. You know, I don't think that's, you know, boy, they were well behaved. Like, I don't think that's what we want people saying.
I don't want them saying that.
No, I want them saying she got every bit of juice out of that orange. You know, she shared with the world even when we didn't always want her to.
I love it. Well, you have a great tool that I have never seen before. I love like kind of tools that help me decipher what's going on when I get all psychologically tangled up about something. And like, I love morning pages and things like that. You call it the 90-second doodle. Is that right? Tell us a little bit about that.
90-second doodle may be my favorite thing. This is amazing. So, and you can all do this with me right now. Think of something that's got you sort of stuck or got you feeling kind of crappy or is upsetting you or something just feels sort of stuck and insolvable and maybe even unpleasant. And grab a piece of scratch paper, an index card or whatever, and a, you know, ballpoint pen, any kind of pen, doesn't matter. And just for 90 seconds, draw a picture of how it feels. Right, and stick figures and scrawly bits are fine. We're not making art here. We're just getting our feelings out onto a piece of paper.
Okay, give us an example.
Let's say I'm worried about money, right? I'm like, okay, what does it feel like to be worried about money? And I might draw, you know, me as a stick figure sort of laying down with a big boulder on top of me. You know, and I color that boulder to be really like dark and heavy. And now that only took me 10 seconds. So now I also draw a bunch of dots to indicate that it's raining because it often feels like I'm cold and wet and under a boulder.
Okay. You're right? Making some visceral descriptions through this illustration, this little sketch.
This little stick figure thing. And that alone is just super helpful to be able to go like, wow, I do feel like I have a heavy weight on me. I do feel like the elements are against me. I do feel cold and wet and alone and under a rock. This is a great way to start a conversation with your partner, with your boss, with your team. You know, just go like, look, here's where I'm at emotionally. You know, this is not just a problem to be solved. There's I'm a person having an experience. And again, even just to articulate it to yourself, even if you don't want to share it with anybody else, that's fine. And then the really sort of nifty part is flip it over or grab another sheet of paper and draw how you would like it to feel. Mm. What would be fun? What would be enlightening? What would be miraculous? What could be? And maybe I find myself, gosh, almost turning that drawing on its side. So then there's me as a little stick figure and me holding a big balloon. You know, maybe that boulder turns into a balloon. Well, that seems like fun. And so maybe I color that like, I was going to say red, but let's do it green for money, you know? And, you know, and now I make the little raindrops, little dollar signs. So it's like raining money. I'm like, oh, well, I would love for it to feel like that. I would love for it to feel like buoyant and like a celebration and like there's money coming down naturally from everywhere and it's effortless and I just get to stand there and be showered by money. I love that feeling. And so now I've got something to go for, you know? Where in my life can I make sales or whatever it is I'm doing feel like that? How can I, you know, cultivate that feeling? Maybe I can even buy myself as a balloon as a treat next time I do my dancing, right? Yeah. You know, get a balloon bouquet or just treat myself in some way. Like it's just, your cues are going to be your cues to you, but you are not an impenetrable mystery to yourself. Like you, and these little simple tools, just doing a simple, it works great with kids too, actually. Just like, how are you feeling? And then saying, wow, it looks like this. I remember doing this with a client one time, about budgeting, and she drew like this giant black bird that like took up the entire page. And I was like, wow, okay, what's that for you? And she goes, I didn't realize how furious I am.
Oh.
She's like, I am so mad. She's like, I don't feel like this should be my job. I am so resentful. I'm so angry. I was like, okay, let's back up and deal with that first, because this is not a budgeting problem. Right? And to approach it as a budgeting problem is not going to solve the problem. So yeah, it's amazing when it comes
out. It's kind of like a lot of ways that we can indicate to ourselves what's going on and what we want to happen. I think sometimes like vision boards and a lot of these things are effective, not because of some magic about laying the images out on a poster or whatever. It's indicating what you want. You've narrowed down the feeling that you want to have. And once you narrow down to the feeling, then, like you mentioned earlier, the universe can conspire with you a little bit. And all of a sudden, you're paying attention to the things that support this vision of yourself rather than just getting evidence for the part of your life that you're in right now that isn't working as well.
Exactly. The other things I love about it is it gets you out of the sort of logical thinking part of your mind. It also gets you out of your habitual thinking, right? I mean, there's, in as much as science or anyone knows what a thought is, apparently we have, I don't know, somewhere between 60 and 100,000 thoughts a day. And most of them are the same ones we had yesterday. So we get these into these habitual thought patterns, and it can be really hard to break out of them. So to do something visual, nonverbal, like, can kind of cut through a lot of that. And also, you know, feelings just want to be felt. That's all feelings want. They just want to be felt. And once they know they've been felt, like they've been drawn and recognized, they can get promoted and get a better job. Right?
That's right. We're talking with Sam Bennett, author of the new book, The 15-Minute Method, The Surprisingly Simple Art of Getting It Done. We just have a few moments left. If we're taking our 15 minutes a day, do you have any kind of umbrella way that you like to recommend people start with choosing how they're going to spend those 15 minutes?
Yeah, so this is the 15-minute method, is spend 15 minutes a day on something that matters to you. That's the whole thing. Ta-da! I got a whole book out of that. But you're right. The question of, well, what matters to me, right? And you may have an intuition about what that is. You may have a bunch of ideas, in which case write down a whole list of them and then pick one every day and try it. Or maybe say, okay, I'm going to try this one for this week and maybe another one for next week. You can also spend 15 minutes staring at a blank piece of paper, because 15 minutes of enforced boredom never hurt a person. And when was the last time you spent 15 minutes without reaching for your phone? So whatever, it's really wide open. I mean, sometimes people use it to tackle the things they know they have to tackle. Like, I got to start prepping for my taxes, or I've got to clean out that garage. Sometimes it's those kind of things. Sometimes it's more interpersonal. You know, I want to spend 15 minutes writing poetry, or in a prayer and spirituality, you know, meditation session. Sometimes it's just reconnecting with the natural world. I have, I have a thing. You can see it on my website. It's called the Daily Practicum. It's a subscription. People buy it. And then every weekday at 12 noon Eastern, we hop on the Zoom, wave hello, start the timer. 15 minutes later, timer goes off. And this gallery of like glowing post-orgasmic faces look up at me and they say, oh my gosh, Sam, I did it. I did it. I made that phone call. I've been putting off that phone call for 6 weeks and I made that phone call. And somebody else says, Sam, I did it. I wrote that note. My friend lost her husband and I didn't know what to say. And I've been wanting to write, and I just wrote it and I sent it and now it's done. And somebody else says, I just spent 15 minutes out in the garden with the sun on my face. Hmm. So really, it's whatever it is that's going to add a little spring to your step, put a little light in your eyes, and that makes you feel good. Spend 15 minutes a day feeling good.
Oh, I love it. Well, any of us who write about creativity have our favorite books that we return to again and again for encouragement and insights. Books like The War of Art, The Artist's Way, Bird by Bird, Kick-Ass Creativity. Your new book, The 15-Minute Method, belongs in that category for anyone looking for support with their creative process. If anyone would like to find out more about Sam Bennett's free resources, newsletter, books, or workshops, you can find her at therealsambennett.com. Is that
That's right? Therealsambennett.com. And you know my team keeps wanting to make the fake Sam Bennett.
Thanks so much for being with us, Sam.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW.
And we've been talking with Sam Bennett, creativity coach and facilitator and all around fun person to talk with about her new book, The 15-Minute Method. If you're interested in more information about the 15-Minute Method, please visit kpcw.org, our website, for more details.
Intermountain Heber Valley Hospital is celebrating 25 years of patient care and service to the community. The hospital, which opened in October of 1999, held a recent celebration of the facility that started as a small 43,000 square foot hospital and now has become an award-winning 68,000 square foot facility, a critical access hospital. And joining me now to tell us all about it is the president of Intermountain Heber Valley Hospital, Cy Hutt. Cy, good morning to you and congratulations.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Lynn.
It's quite a thing. And as we were just speaking about trying to get years straight of what happened when, as those of us in Park City may or may not remember, that Park City Hospital opened in 2009. But way back before that, in 1999, Intermountain Heber Valley Hospital opened. And Cy, can you describe to us, I know you weren't there at the time, but describe to us what that small facility was like back then.
You bet. Well, the county had operated the hospital in Heber for much of its existence. In 1975, Intermountain started doing the management, but in 1999, we built a new hospital, and that was actually owned by Intermountain. So it was exciting for Intermountain to actually own the facility and be there, and it really started as a rural hospital in, under a rural model.
Okay. Well, this is an interesting distinction because what are the sort of parameters for it being a rural hospital? I believe Park City Hospital is a rural hospital, but is Heber Valley Hospital still designated rural? I mean, it's in this thriving metropolis of Heber City.
That's exactly right. I would not so much look at designation, but how a rural hospital operates. And frequently you have family practice physicians who are doing the majority of things in the hospital when you're on a rural model. You have a couple of specialties frequently. General surgery will be there, et cetera. But as you move more into what I would say a community hospital, and that's what we are looking like now is a small community hospital, you bring in a lot more specialists. And that really over the last 10 years, that's been the evolution at Heber Valley Hospital.
We quite often on this show talk to some of your specialists that it seems work now between Heber Valley Hospital and Park City Hospital, or maybe they're just at Heber Valley Hospital. So what this tells us is that these specialties are becoming more robust and, you know, filled with patients. How many specialists work full time at the hospital?
You bring up a really good point, Lynn. You know, specialists require a certain number in the population to support. So we've really tried to work between Heber Valley and Park City Hospital to have enough population to bring those specialties. And then as the population grows in just one area to be able to support that specialist, then they're kind of full-time in that area. So we have, I would say, close to two dozen specialists that are full-time on the Wasatch back.
Yeah, that makes it really nice for those specialists because it seems like, you know, previously a specialist might be commuting between Salt Lake and Heber or Park City and Salt Lake, and now they can kind of live, work, play along the Wasatch back, which must be nice. And it's that way for you, I assume.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it is. It's a wonderful place to live, and it's nice to be able to work close to where you live. And we usually when we open up a position for a physician, we have a lot of folks who are interested.
I bet. Well, it seems like it wasn't very long ago that if you were going to have a baby, you had to go to the Salt Lake Valley to have that baby delivered. Now there have been 230 babies delivered at Heber Valley Hospital just this year alone. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're anticipating we'll have about 270 babies born this year at the Heber Valley Hospital, which is awesome. And babies have been delivered at this hospital for quite a while, but like I mentioned, primarily your family practice physicians were doing those deliveries. We now are in a model where our OBGYNs here, we have two OBGYNs, Dr. Cook and Dr. Longnecker, and they'll be joined by Dr. Katie Shepherd in January, do those deliveries.
And speaking of employees in general, you have just over 200 employees. This is a huge employer in the Heber Valley. Do you have any idea in terms of who is the biggest employer in the Valley? Is this right up among the top?
It really is. Yeah, I think as far as a private employer, we are definitely one of the largest. And then like most small communities, your county and your school districts, and those are also very large employers.
Now, it seems like Heber Valley Hospital has had a very small surgery center for quite some time, but with nearly 1,200 surgeries performed, annually, what kind of surgeries are performed there and how extensive has the surgery center become?
Yeah, it's a really critical part of our operations, and we have expanded in surgeries. We do orthopedic surgery, general surgery, ophthalmology, ENT surgery. We've just added a urologist, Dr. Richard Van Langendonk, who also works at Park City. And so really what I would say is most of your primary surgeries are offered here. If you need, brain surgery or heart surgery, something like that, we don't offer that in our community. But most of the surgeries are available here locally.
It really gives this sense of feeling of, safety and just feeling like the access to health care is right there in the Valley. In your sort of going around the community and in your job, what are the kinds of stories that you hear or the feedback that you get about every time you expand, and it seems like you're expanding all the time?
Yeah, it's wonderful to bring those services locally. We, in 2020, we opened chemotherapy, for example, and that's something that you don't want to have to drive down regularly to the Valley for something like that. It already tires you out and is challenging for family dynamics. So the more things that we can bring locally so you just don't have to go outside the community, the more that we want. And every time we do provide a new physician or a new service, we hear a lot of positives from the community. One of the things that I really love about Heber is just the personal nature. We mm-hmm. still, we still feel like a small hospital. And so I often hear that comment when people come in is, this place just feels good. And it really does. You've got a lot of very skilled people who are also just really nice and take care of you as you're taking care of a neighbor. You don't get lost in the crowd. You're not just another number. You're an individual, and we're able to provide individualized care. It's quick, it's easy, and it's friendly.
Well, you were at Park City Hospital at the helm from 2012 to 2018, and I believe you went right over to Heber Valley Hospital from here. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Well, can you characterize some of the similarities and differences between the two hospitals?
Yeah, I think they're when you look at the patient experience, and that's something we really focus on at both hospitals, we are both five-star hospitals with Medicare. So the patient experience at both hospitals is really very, very strong. We also, when you look at quality indicators, they are very good at both hospitals. There's a company called Chartis that looks at your critical access hospitals. You mentioned that we're designated as a critical access hospital. That's a Medicare designation for smaller hospitals. There's about 1,300 of those hospitals in the United States. And for the last 2 years, we've been named one of the top 100 performing critical access hospitals. And that's based on a broad set of metrics on patient experience, safety, quality, financial investment, community confidence, et cetera. And then Park City Hospital also is recognized as one of the best performing hospitals in the nation as a community hospital. So what we love is regardless of which hospital you're going to, you're going to have a good experience and a good outcome.
Well, those are really impressive qualifications, I would say. But the most important thing is, does Heber Valley Hospital have as good of a restaurant as Park City Hospital has with the Silver King Cafe? I love that place.
It's awesome. Yes, you know, the hospital food is not what it used to be. And so we've got the chef over here, Chef Tim, and he does a great job. He brings a lot of energy, and he and his team do a marvelous job, whether it's serving up our patients or doing a catering event. They are fun, they are creative, and they know how to make good food.
Right, absolutely. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the emergency room. The room you've had about, annually you get somewhere in the neighborhood of about 8,000 emergency room visits. And that's a pretty robust emergency room, I would say. I don't really know. Those numbers sound pretty significant. And I suppose you're drawing a lot of patients that are coming in from, you know, out in the Uintas and places like that. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right, Lynn. We differ a little bit from Park City as far as when our peaks are. So we're seeing a lot of trauma at Park City Hospital during ski season, and we're seeing a lot of trauma at Heber Valley Hospital during the summer with four-wheeler accidents and various things coming off, again, of outdoor recreation. So we do see a lot of influx of members coming into our community that unfortunately their trip didn't go as they hoped and have to make a trip into the ER. But we also, with our community that's growing so much, we're seeing, you know, the full variety of emergencies that come in to our hospital. And that's something we also really have changed over the last 10 years. The emergency department group covers both hospitals. They're all board certified ED trained physicians. They're in the hospital 24/7. And we are a level 4 trauma designated hospital, part of the state of Utah trauma network. And I think it's been one of the areas of biggest transition within the hospital over this last decade.
So as our two communities meld together here, if you live sort of halfway between Park City and Heber, and you find yourself needing emergency room access, and you're not going, say, in an ambulance, but where are you going to choose? It's easy to say, don't come to Park City if it's rush hour. but are those two emergency rooms similar?
You know, if you're having an emergency, you want to get to the closest emergency department. So yeah, it might depend on time of day, where the traffic is, et cetera. But you want to get to the closest one because they can stabilize and assist, determine what you need, if it can be handled, you know, there at the hospital, or if you need to be transferred out. But a lot of the capabilities are the same. Park City has a few more services than Heber does. But what's critical in an emergency is just getting into the emergency department.
Well, it says here that in your statistics that you have 19 licensed beds. So does that mean that you would have a maximum of 19 people spending the night in the hospital? Is that how that reads? I don't know what that means exactly.
No, that's a great way to say it. Yes. If you're spending the night in the hospital, between our labor and delivery unit and our medical and surgical floor, we have 19 beds.
Okay. So how often are those 19 beds fully occupied?
They're getting more and more frequently. It really is an issue where in a lot of smaller hospitals, you can go from nearly full to nearly empty in just a couple of days. So that's a hard thing to try to manage that our team does a great job of. But we are seeing us move to capacity more frequently.
Well, with the Heber Valley being one of the fastest growing, you know, areas in the state, if not the country, what are, if any, the expansion plans or, you know, are the services that are needed just expanding so rapidly it's sort of hard to keep up?
Yeah, there's so many changes in healthcare as well. Determining, the right venue and the right way to build it is also a strategic challenge. But we're seeing, for example, telehealth is providing specialties that we never thought we would have available here on the Wasatch Back are now available to us, even though our population hasn't grown to be able to support them. They are able to consult via telehealth, work with the physicians here locally to provide care, which is awesome. I mentioned that we started chemotherapy in 2020, and when we did that, we had teleoncology. We're actively recruiting for an oncologist who will be in clinic in both Heber and in Park City, and so we hope to bring that service in next year. We're adding cardiology services as well. So it's just really as that population grows and allows us to bring in new services, we will continue to do that and develop the facilities as needed. And then, you know, just those, I guess you'd say core specialties, for example, your primary care specialties. It wasn't that long ago when it was mostly family practice. We still have great family practice physicians here who do an awesome job for both adults and children. We have two pediatricians and are actively recruiting for a third pediatrician. We have three internal medicine physicians, and as I mentioned, the three OBGYNs. So as the population grows, we continue to build in those specialties we already have as well.
A question about telehealth. It's wonderful what telehealth is doing, improving access, especially for people in rural communities. But it would seem to me that I was trying to think of a rural community that's way out there, but the only thing that popped into my head is Duchesne, which isn't really way out there, but it's a distance. So telehealth, obviously you can, you know, talk on the phone or via computer to anyone anywhere, but is there for these, you know, rural and community hospitals, is there incentive for the patient to, while they're doing telehealth, develop a relationship with the closest hospital that would be Heber Valley Hospital, for example?
Yeah, that is an excellent point because you want to be part of a medical community and a medical network. So I do think it's beneficial to have a primary care physician who you see, and maybe some of your visits are through telehealth or you're communicating through email, but somebody who knows you and knows your condition. That's a really important thing. But for example, I'll give an example of how we're using telehealth at Heber. So if you maybe come into the emergency department and you're having a stroke, we have teleneurology that's there available working side by side with the ER physician to determine now what's the treatment. Can we do that in Heber? Do we need to transfer that patient out? Can they be discharged home? Helping making all of those decisions. If that patient then needed to be admitted to the hospital, again, through teleneurology, we'd have our local hospitalist taking care of the patient, but they would be consulting with that neurologist to make sure that the care is the same that you would get if you were at IMED or, you know, one of the larger hospitals. And then while you mentioned we have 19 beds, so it's not a huge hospital. So having full-time hospitalists is something that we'll probably have in the future, but we don't have right now. So the same physicians who are taking care of the community in the clinic, also six of them share responsibilities of taking care of patients when they're in the hospital. Well, as you can imagine, if you've, you know, taken care of a patient and get two or three calls in the middle of the night, that can be pretty disruptive to your sleep. And then the next day you've got a full clinic. That's pretty hard. So we also have telehospitalists who work with our local physicians at night. So from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., you've got a physician who is right there monitoring things, ready to answer any questions from nursings or the patient, and doesn't disrupt the local guy's sleep. So they're fresh and ready to go that next morning and take over care again at 7 a.m. And so that's been really, really beneficial for our providers here locally.
Yeah, wow, that sounds excellent. You know, that term hospitalist, has it been around for a long time? Because I feel like I've just heard this term, or maybe it's expanded more recently.
Yeah, it is. It is newer and expanding, and it's just because that old model of your primary care physician or your specialist taking care of you both in the hospital and outside of the hospital 24/7, it just doesn't provide a very good lifestyle for the physicians. So as we've grown into that, you have physicians who are focused just on the hospital. They are just taking care of you while you're there, making sure we're following best practices. They're up to speed on the latest things that are happening in the hospital world. So it's a really strong thing for lifestyle, but it also is helpful from a patient care standpoint.
Cy Hutt is the president of Intermountain Heber Valley Hospital. And Cy, is there anything before I let you go that's on your wish list for the next phase of the Heber Valley Hospital, or anything else you want to add?
Oh, thank you very much, Lynn. No, we're just really excited. You know, Intermountain has been an important part of this community for the last, last half century, but particularly last quarter century. And we look forward to being here for the next half century. We work closely with a lot of not-for-profit partners that are in both in the Heber Valley as well as in the Park City area. And we have so many great partners. The Wasatch Back is just a wonderful place to be, from the county health departments to, you know, Wasatch Community Foundation to Holy Cross Ministries, the People's Health Clinic. There's so many entities that do a wonderful job and that we support and partner with to make the Wasatch Back a fabulous place to live.
Well, I agree. The Wasatch Back is a fabulous place. Cy, thank you so much for your time today, and congratulations on 25 years of the Heber Valley Hospital. It's been nice speaking with you.
It's been wonderful, Lynn. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. If you like today's episode, please rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends. And if you have an idea for the show, please email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.